Is the dominant narrative about the Native American community too one-sided?
In the last 500 years, Native people, we survived slavery and smallpox and the measles. We've survived the Spanish, the English, the French. We've survived Custer. He didn't survive us, but nonetheless, we have survived every assault on our being for 500 years. Not just survived, we found ways to thrive.
That's Native American writer and critic David Troyer. We spend the hour talking with him about his latest book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. It's out this month from Riverhead Books. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When David Troyer was growing up on the Leech Lake Ojibwe Reservation in northern Minnesota, he saw plenty of poverty and dysfunction. But he also saw examples of great strength and resilience, beginning with his own mother. She overcame dire poverty to become an Ojibwe tribal court judge. So as Troyer grew up to become an anthropologist and a writer, he was disturbed at the depictions of Native Americans in literature and culture that emphasized only the tragedy of Native American life without celebrating its triumphs, the greatest triumph being to survive. And now in the 21st century, after 500 years of oppression, to be in the midst of a revival of Native American culture and political engagement. Troyer's book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, is a brilliant examination of the post-conquest history of Native America through the lens of survival and resilience. Troyer doesn't shrink from describing the horrors visited on Indians by the white man, but he celebrates the indomitable spirit of the tribes and their peoples. In The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, David Troyer melds history with reportage and memoir. Tracing the tribe's distinctive cultures from first contact, he explores how the depredations of each era spawned new modes of survival. The devastating seizures of land gave rise to increasingly sophisticated legal and political maneuvering that put the lie to the myth that Indians don't know or care about property. The forced assimilation of children at government-run boarding schools created a unifying Native identity. Conscription in the U.S. military and the pull of urban life brought Indians into the mainstream and modern times, even as it steered the emerging shape of self-rule and spawned a new generation of resistance. The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee is an essential, intimate story of a resilient people in a transformative time. David Troyer is the author of numerous books, including novels, essays, and memoir. He's a professor of literature and teaches in the University of Southern California's PhD program in creative writing and literature. Well, David Troyer, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This is just a terrific book and beautifully written, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. You set out in this book to counter the common narrative about the American Indian and to pose a different narrative, one that emphasizes resilience and strengths of the Native American community. And you said you wanted a book that would dismantle the tale of our demise by way of a new story. Tell us more about that. What is the counter narrative? What's the narrative first and then the counter narrative?
It's always seemed to me that the only kind of story that people tell about Native American people is one of destruction and loss. And it's easy to see why that's the dominant narrative. I mean, we have lost a lot. We went from being the sole inhabitants and owners of North America in 1492 to within a few hundred years controlling much, much less of it. But I remember reading Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee when I was in college. And I remember being really frustrated and really, really hurt by that book, because as much of an ally as Dee Brown was, and he was a tremendous ally and of and proponent of Native people. In the very first page of that book, he says something to the effect of, "This book takes, you know, this book focuses on the Plains Wars. I start in 1850 and I end in 1890 at the massacre at Wounded Knee Creek, where the culture and civilization of the American Indian was finally destroyed." It's something like that. And he goes on to say that, you know, if you happen to travel to a modern Indian reservation and see the squalor and poverty and hopelessness, perhaps by reading this book, you will understand why. And I remember feeling a lot when I read that introduction when I was 19 years old. I remember feeling both happy that someone was paying attention to the contours of our lives, and also at the same time silenced by his assessment that we were gone, that we were destroyed, that the culture and civilization of the American Indian was gone. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I'm not gone, and my tribe's not gone, and my community's not gone, and we're here, and we're not just here, but we're doing all sorts of things. And so I wanted, and I searched for years for stories that told the stories of our lives rather than the story of our death. And I didn't find any. And so, as Toni Morrison says, if there's a book you want to read and it doesn't exist, well, then you should probably write it.
Yeah. And as you mentioned Wounded Knee, it's really emblematic of this. And you talk about Wounded Knee. You know, I think the picture we have is just of the massacre, but something else survived. So tell us about Wounded Knee itself, the original one, and what you saw as coming out of that, that is different than the narrative that we have.
Well, Wounded Knee was a massacre that occurred on Pine Ridge Reservation in December of 1890 after the murder of Sitting Bull. There was widespread anxiety among the Native people in South Dakota. It was a pretty tense time. There was a military buildup. The government kept pouring more troops and more arms into the Great Sioux Reservation because the army and the government were afraid of an uprising because of the increasing popularity of the ghost dance. So everyone was on edge, Native people, the government, and when you have a lot of different people who don't trust each other on edge and you have a lot of guns, something bad is almost inevitably going to happen. And sure enough, there was some bands of Lakota who were fleeing, and they were surrounded by the military. There was a scuffle. It's unclear who shot first or how it began, but almost immediately after that scuffle and after some guns went off, the government opened fire with Hotchkiss cannons on largely unarmed and predominantly American Indian women and children. And when it was done, estimates vary, but between 120 and over 300 Native people were killed. And it wasn't just this initial flurry of violence. It was a sort of a bloodlust kind of took over the military, where they chased women and children down on horseback upwards of a mile or two down these ravines and shot them in the back and mutilated their bodies. And for almost instantly, that massacre became emblematic of, for lots of people, the death of American Indians, for the rapaciousness of the government. Sort of, it stood in for the entire, you know, 200-year relationship between, well, not quite 200 years, but 150-year relationship between the U.S. government and Native people. And it was an awful massacre. It also happened right at the time when the government officially declared the frontier closed and the United States officially settled. And Frederick Jackson Turner's frontier hypothesis was promoted by him at the Columbia World Exposition, I think, 3 years later. And it was really a turning point. This was the point at which tribes ceased to be thought of as free or unencumbered, and the long sort of winter of reservation life was to have begun. In reality, the reservation system was already well established, and in reality, our lives didn't end. And one thing that always struck me about the massacre is that everyone has always, of course, with good reason, focused on the men, women, and children who were so brutally butchered, but no one paid much attention to the people who survived. And even if you put the figures at 300 dead, many, many more walked away from Wounded Knee and went about their lives and got married and found work and found ways to practice their native religions, and some converted to Christianity and some went to school and some didn't. They sort of fanned out into America and continued to live. And those are the people I wanted to focus on. And that's what I wanted the book to focus on, were the ways in which we've been living ever since 1890. And I felt that if we looked closely and with artistry at Indian lives rather than Indian deaths, we would see something different about us, but we'd also see something different about our country.
Something different about our country?
Sure. I mean, people have always thought of, you know, Indians as in America, but not of America. And I've always felt that if you really want to understand what this country is about, if you want to understand its ideals, and if you want to understand its mistakes, if you want to understand the way power works inside our government and despite our government, if you want to understand the effects of federal policy or the importance of the composition of the Supreme Court, if you want to understand the relationship between the federal government and states, you need to look at Indian country. There were more Supreme Court decisions about American Indian issues in the 1970s and 80s than there were Supreme Court decisions about banking, about finance, about the death penalty, about reproductive rights. And the Supreme Court sort of understood itself, or sort of came to be what it is, because it paid attention to the tricky issue of tribal sovereignty. That's just one example. So if you want to understand America, you have to look at us.
Could you say a little bit more about how that Supreme Court decision over tribal sovereignty?
Many decisions, like dozens of decisions.
Pick one.
Well, for instance, I mean, the argument about federal power versus states' rights has been going on since the country was founded. It's pretty unclear how much power should the states have, how much power should the government have, should the government have. All of those issues have been tricky, but there are really three powers at play in the land, namely states, the federal government, and Indian tribes. And so when issues like tribal gaming came up in the 1980s, the Supreme Court had to think hard about, well, gaming is really a state issue, but tribes aren't states. They're sovereign nations within the United States. So how do we make decisions about how tribes game in states that don't allow gaming? And it brings into sharp focus what power states have, for example, and what powers they don't to regulate things like gaming or banking and so on.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Troyer about his book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. It's a sweeping history of the resilience of Native American people in the face of oppression and injustice. Louise Erdrich, who writes from a Native American, mostly about Native American issues, wrote a whole novel about the different jurisdiction over violence against women. I mean, women who are raped or murdered, if they're raped or murdered on a reservation, who does it if they're raped or murdered off a reservation? Is this something of what you're talking about as well?
Sure. Congress passed the Violence Against Women Act, I think, in the 1990s, and it was recently updated to include broader protections for Native women. One of the problems with all these overlapping and jigsaw jurisdictions, federal crimes, state crimes, et cetera, And tribal courts as well, were that tribal courts could only prosecute perpetrators of sexual violence against Native women on Native land if the perpetrators were Native. But the Justice Department has recently issued reports suggesting that over 70% of violent crimes perpetrated against Native women are perpetrated by non-Native men. Tribes were very interested in tribes were very interested in prosecuting crimes against Native women. Counties, not so much. The state, not so much. And so a lot of these non-Native perpetrators sort of went unpunished. But through a lot of hard work and advocacy, the Violence Against Women Act was strengthened to give, for the first time, tribal courts and tribal police departments jurisdiction over non-Native men. They can charge and try non-Native people in tribal court for the first time. That's huge.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Troyer about his book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. Now, you are of both Native American and Jewish background. You write in the book that your father just barely survived the Holocaust, so we can see that there are really two Holocausts in your background. Talk about your family and how that influenced your perspective in growing up.
Growing up, I always wanted what in my limited imagination I thought of as a normal family. And of course, the more closely you look at anything, the stranger it gets. And so I never felt growing up that there was any other kind of family like mine. Native on my mother's side, Jewish on my father's side. I was born in Washington, D.C., but raised on the reservation, on my family's reservation. My father was such an interesting guy. He had a whole life and a family, three children, before he met my mother and married her and had children with us. And when he moved to the reservation, in his own words, I mean, he felt like he finally found the place where he belonged. He said, "Look, I'd been chased out of Europe. I'd been unwelcome and I'd been persecuted there. And I felt like I never belonged or I wasn't allowed to belong. And I felt the same in America itself. And when I finally came to the reservation, I felt like I was home. It was a place that I understood, full of people that I also understood and who understood me." And he wasn't wrong. My father was spent the majority of his life helping Native people and supporting Native causes with a kind of boundless energy and creativity and compassion that I struggle to emulate. So he was a really, really good role model growing up. I didn't think that when I was growing up, of course. I thought he was strange and awkward, and I couldn't stand him and all the things that teenagers usually think. And my mother, came from abject poverty to become one of the first Native American women lawyers in the country and the very first Native American woman judge. And so, I mean, my background was really unusual in that I was in the mix. I was raised Native on my reservation with my big extended family, made up of a lot of ne'er-do-wells, by the way. But by two parents who believed in education and social justice and who believed passionately in the strength and power and intelligence of Native people, individually and collectively. And as my father put it, when I asked him about his relationship with America, he said, "Look, America, if not for this country, I'd be dead. I mean, this country saved my life. I would be dead. I wouldn't exist if not for finding refuge here." But then at the same time, I asked him next, I'm like, "Well, what about all of its mistakes? What about all of its ugliness?" And he said, "Well, I love it so much that I've taken it as my life mission to make it better.
A very Jewish thing to say, by the way.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe so.
So, you know, one of the great points in this book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, David Troyer, is that you go into the specificity of the different tribes and their history, how they responded to the depredations on them by the colonialists, by the white settlers and, you know, the U.S. government, how they dealt with things in different ways. You say from 1890 to the present, but you actually start before then. And I wonder if you could say, give us the example of the Great Lakes region, which you said was home to some of the bloodiest fighting, but also some of the most effective Indian resistance to colonization on the entire continent, just as an example, of people fighting back.
Well, I mean, in terms of prehistory or in terms of more modern stuff?
Specifically, you're going back to fighting back against colonization.
Right. Well, there was, I mean, for example, just in my tribe, for example, once again, the story that we've often heard is that, you know, European settlers came and they brought disease and guns and Indians just sort of faded away because we had no immunity and blah, blah, blah. And then white people took over and it's so not fair, so sad, too bad. Why don't we go to the mall? And but in fact, I mean, the story is much more interesting, much more complicated, because around the Great Lakes, for instance, we knew, and the French and the British knew this too, that if you could control the Great Lakes, specifically, say, you know, the narrows between Lake Michigan and the rest of the Great Lakes by Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, by, you know, Lake Michigan and Lake Superior, if you could control the Great Lakes in, and I'm talking about, you know, back in the 16th, 17th, and early 18th centuries, if you could control that area, you could control all trade and traffic across the continent, because if you controlled the Great Lakes, you controlled all the movement north and south, because in those days, there were no roads. You got around by using rivers and lakes. Those were the highways and the railroads of, you know, the colonial period. You could control all of the movement between Hudson Bay and the Gulf of Mexico and between the Rocky Mountains and the Atlantic Ocean. And my tribe, in sort of in collaboration with some other tribes like the Ottawa and the Potawatomi, formed this empire that effectively controlled the Great Lakes. And one thing that we knew was that if we could keep the colonial powers on equal footing, that is, if we could keep the balance of power between the British and the French more or less equal, they would always need us to gain advantage over the other. So if the French were getting too powerful, we would make an alliance with the British, and then we would attack the French. And if the British got too powerful, then we'd switch allegiances and join up with the French and attack the British. And this, for a couple hundred years, kept both Britain and France from gaining the upper hand, which meant that we always had the upper hand. So during that time period, our land base grew by a factor of 20. Our life expectancy increased. Infant mortality went down. Standards of living went up. And that put us in a really advantageous position once the British and French both lost effectively to the Americans.
And what was your tribe, by the way?
Ojibwe. Yeah. And this is one example of, you know, a creative counter to, you know, the juggernaut of colonialism. Yeah. And it just amuses me to no end, you know, to think about that period in history.
Right. I mean, in fact, they were pursuing a kind of divide and conquer strategy.
Absolutely. And, you know, also, I mean, just going back, you know, again, into prehistory, the tribes we think of as the Plains tribes, so thinking of the Lakota and the Dakota of what's now North Dakota and South Dakota, they used to be woodland tribes. They used to be around the Great Lakes too, in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And we fought them and pushed them further west out onto the plains. And after the Pueblo Revolt in the 17th century, horses were sort of unleashed onto the plains within 100 years, all those plains tribes had horses, and then later they had guns. And it's interesting to think of, we think of sort of the ultimate, that the end of the story of the Plains Wars was the defeat of the Lakota. But what would things have looked like if the Dakota hadn't expanded their territory, if they hadn't engaged in war after war? And when the treaty making process started with the American government, they didn't have horses and they didn't have guns and they hadn't fought. Would they even be here today? Which they are. And the answer is probably not. So on one hand, a violent relationship with the American government did promote violence, but it might have also bought them years, generations, to build strong leadership, to increase their numbers, and so that when they finally went to the treaty table with the American government, they did so from a position of at least greater strength than they might have otherwise.
As opposed, for example, to the California Indians who were utterly decimated.
Right. Yeah, California is such a unique example. I mean, there were more tribes, more different tribes with different languages and different customs in California, hundreds of different distinct tribes than in the rest of the country. And there was this incredible diversity all up and down the coast. And when colonization occurred, that diversity didn't necessarily serve California tribes, and the government and prospectors, and then eventually the state of California, were effectively able to do incredible damage to California native people. It was some of the worst in the country.
Yeah, real genocide.
Yeah, exactly.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with David Troyer about his book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. You divide this book into three sections, and the second section is called Purgatory. Why is that?
Well, the first part is sort of, I call narrating the apocalypse, and the second part is purgatory, and the third part is a little more open-ended. There was this, what I think of a middle passage that I think of as the years after Wounded Knee, and maybe stretching through the 1960s when tribes had been, or 1940s, say, when tribal government had been effectively dismantled by the United States government. The reservation system was firmly in place, where we were really disenfranchised and almost depopulated. In 1900, according to the census, there were fewer than 200,000 Native people left alive in the United States. Without effective forms of government, without any kind of power or access to it. And I think of it as a middle passage. To borrow a metaphor from the slave trade. During that period, there were constant assaults on our land in the form of the Dawes Act, on our families in the form of residential boarding schools, on our traditions in the form of Bureau of Indian Affairs policy that made our religions illegal. And in fact, our native religions were illegal officially until 1978, with the passage of the Indian Religious Freedom Act. And in that sort of time of subjugation, in that time of disenfranchisement, nonetheless, there were Native people working in Native government, Native people joining the army, Native people fighting in, for the First World War and in the Second World War, and then subsequently in Korea. Native people who went to boarding school, and instead of having their culture erased, they found themselves in contact with Native people from other tribes whom they never would have met if they hadn't gone to these compulsory boarding schools. And in all these processes, Native people were acquiring skills and knowledge and educations and language and networks. And they were able to use all of that to promote and strengthen their individual lives and the lives of their communities more generally. And they sort of, that generation, those generations, which we might think of as lost, are the ones who saved us and provided a foundation on which later generations, including mine, could build.
Back in 1993, I visited Glacier National Park, and I became friends with a young woman. Myra Makes Cold Weather was her name, or is her name. I haven't been in touch with her for many years, but she invited me to a sweat lodge ceremony that her family was putting on. Her father was a medicine man. And then I went back the following year where there was, you know, I guess there was a yearly get-together of the Blackfoot tribe from Canada. All the Canadian tribes would come down to Montana, or maybe, you know, this time it was just being held in Montana. And I went to another sweat lodge ceremony, and I met a man there who told me he'd grown up in an Indian school. And I said, wow, boy, that must have been really, really hard, because, of course, I'd heard all the horror stories. And he said, well, it wasn't too bad. It was three hots and a cot. But he was very, very glad to have married into this traditional family with, you know, the head of the family being a medicine man and now learning all the old ways. And I think that really kind of encapsulates a bit of what you're talking about.
Oh, exactly so. It's so easy for us. And I found myself when I was younger, and I noticed it in other people, I found myself judging, you know, previous generations. Oh, you know, you sold out, or, oh, you know, where's your politics? And of course, I thought those things with all of this sort of egotism of youth and not really thinking about what it meant to survive back then, what it meant to go to those schools and have your traditions and sense of self and your connection to your family so threatened. And I didn't think about what that was like, with the alternative being starvation for so many people. And then when I got older and I, you know, life dealt me, you know, the hand it did, and subsequently I developed a lot more humility, I came to see the things that those previous generations had gone through with a lot more compassion and a lot more gratitude. You know, my mother's suffering and her response to it, which was so positive, is the only reason why I have the life I have, connected to my tribe and intent on making both my tribe and my country better, and having access and standing in my tribal religion in our tribal religious societies. And so that man's story is very much the story of many people, and the kind of story that I was interested in telling in this book.
David Troyer. Stay tuned for more of our conversation with him about his book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. That's right after the break.
Boy, I was raised
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today talking with David Troyer about the resilience of Native American people throughout post-conquest history in the face of oppression and injustice. His book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, is a counter-narrative to the view that Native Americans are, if they exist at all, a people marked only by poverty and decay. Let's get back to our conversation. One of the people you talk about in this book and who you visit is Kevin Washburn, and he was at a certain point, I guess the head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Talk about the evolution of that agency from its beginning, where it really was the instrument of so much of this assimilationist policy that was so destructive to Native American traditions, to where it is today.
First, the government didn't know how to deal with Native people. I mean, how should we be administered to? And initially, the Indian office was housed in the War Department, which kind of made sense because our relationship was quasi-contractual and quasi-martial. And eventually, I think it was President Grant who moved the Indian office out of the War Department and housed it inside of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I'm sorry, inside the Department of the Interior. And Grant was, for all his faults as a president, and there were many, quite passionate about doing right by Native people, often misguided, often without foresight, but nonetheless, he wasn't Andrew Jackson. He wasn't antagonistically disposed toward us. And President Grant's personal secretary was a Seneca man named Eli Parker, and he put him in charge of the Office of Indian Affairs, as it was known then, and really tried his best to do what he thought was best for Native people, made a lot of mistakes. But that office was always, despite Native involvement and despite Grant's well wishes, was always very paternalistic. We know what's best for Native people. We will tell you how it is, and we will tell you what you need to do, treating us as wards of the state, which technically we were, because we weren't citizens yet, and we didn't achieve citizenship until 1924.
Yeah, explain that.
The relationship between the United States government and Native people was one of guardian and ward. The government controlled our money and dispensed it to us as it thought, it should be. We weren't citizens. There was a piecemeal approach in those early days to citizenship. So there were some Native people who were citizens of U.S. citizens in the late 19th century and early 20th century. But we weren't officially citizens until the passage of the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924, I believe. And that largely came about as a result of the overwhelming numbers of Native people who volunteered to fight in the First World War. And they volunteered to fight, and they weren't even citizens of the country for whom they were fighting. So there was this widespread paternalism on the part of the United States government in relation to Native people. And that persisted through the 19th century, into the 20th century, even after citizenship, through the 1930s and 40s. You couldn't do anything. You couldn't pay for anything as a government. So if a tribe wanted to build a road, they had to talk to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. If the tribe wanted housing, they had to go to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. If the tribe wanted access to healthcare or a school, they had to go through the office of, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. You couldn't do anything. If you wanted to convene a tribal council meeting, that had to be run through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. All of it went through the BIA. It was in charge of everything, and it mismanaged everything. The best and brightest didn't often go into the BIA. And it was only really in the 1960s and 70s, through the hard work of tribal government and tribal officials and people like my dad, in fact, that they were able to break that kind of paternalistic stranglehold and really force the Bureau of Indian Affairs to become an agent for Native people, to get that agency to work on our behalf and to get it to stop working against us, frankly. And Kevin Washburn, I think he was in charge of the Bureau in the mid-2000s, maybe like 2010, around that time. And Kevin is just a great example of a brilliant, experienced, competent, doesn't even begin to cover it, leader whose mantra, whose guiding principle is that Native people are intelligent and capable, and they know better than anyone what they need and what will work for them. And so when tribes would come to him, he would say, "Well, what do you want? What do you need? How can we help you?" That was a sea change in how that agency worked in relation to Native communities. And Kevin was a big part of that. He's sort of one of my heroes.
Is he also Native American?
He's definitely from Oklahoma.
Yeah, it used to be called the BIA Bossing Indians Around.
Right, that's what we used to say. BIA stands for, Bossing Indians Around. And it's very much very true for a long time.
Now, was he around when that suit against the BIA happened that showed that there had been millions, maybe billions of dollars that had been lost or wasted or mismanaged that had were supposed to have gone to the tribes but didn't talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the dates in front of me, but Kevin would have been, that suit is it's ongoing, and I don't remember when it's filed, but he would have been in the mix, for sure, and certainly not culpable, but he would have been director of the BIA after the suit had been filed, and I don't think it's been resolved yet, but he would have been at the helm during some of those negotiations, and from what I can tell, in no way responsible for those mistakes of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which goes back into the 19th century.
Well, let's fast forward here a bit. So, this book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, David Troyer, Native America from 1890 to the present, there's a real sea change with the American Indian movement as well. I wonder if you could talk about how that movement got started and how it changed the landscape.
Sure. So the American Indian movement, I cover that in the book, began in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and it was really a movement that grew out of large urban Indian populations in places like Chicago and Minneapolis and Oakland and Cleveland and Los Angeles. It didn't begin in reservation communities. It began in cities. And it drew part of its inspiration from civil rights movement a la Martin Luther King Jr., and also partly from the kind of aesthetic, if not the politics, of the Black Panthers. It was largely militant. It was less peaceful than the kind of civil disobedience that was the hallmark of, civil rights, mainstream civil rights. And they did things like they took over the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C., twice, I believe, and a missile silo base in, or a Navy base in Illinois. A different movement called the Red Power Movement took over Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Harbor, San Francisco Bay. And all of these high-profile takeovers were meant to raise awareness of the raise awareness in the country that A, we still exist, and B, the United States government has not been doing right by us. In terms of direct political action, the American Indian Movement didn't have a lot of influence, but in terms of those two things I mentioned, of drawing attention to us and that our continued existence, and drawing attention to the ways in which the government had failed us, they were very effective. And that was really important. Because until that point, people were like, Indians still exist, And AIM was there to say, absolutely, and in your face. And it was pretty important.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with David Troyer about his book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. So I wonder if you could draw a line then from the American Indian Movement, from AIM. There was also the Second Battle of Wounded Knee, which we haven't talked about. And today, I mean, today, the people of the Northern Plains are dealing with things like the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Bakken oil fields and the real environmental threats to their water, to their land, not to speak of to the water, to the rest of the world in terms of this is the dirtiest energy possible. So connect the dots for us between that older movement and this one. What might have been some of the lessons learned and where you see this going?
Right. Well, AIM was really important and it did a lot of good things, but it also, as an organization, made a lot of mistakes. It empowered in its leadership a lot of men who were plagued by violence. There was a lot of violence against women in the American Indian movement in the 70s. Their confrontations with the government often resulted in loss of life, but not a change of circumstances. It was often chauvinistic, and it was often destructive to the people in the organization and to the communities where the organization took action. It was, in many ways, as effective as it was in raising consciousness, it could also be really destructive emotionally, physically. And the new generation of activists that we see in North Dakota protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline, for instance, seem to have learned a lot from AIM. They learned in the power of direct action. They learned that sometimes even strong physical protests, and I hesitate to say violence because at the Standing Rock protests, the protesters and water protectors were in no way violent in relation to the government, but the government and private security firms were certainly violent in relation to the Native people at that protest. But they learned that, like from AIM, that putting yourself and your bodies on the line is important. But they also learned how to share power and how to sort of not just stand in power, but to do it in ways that were much healthier than in previous generations. So at Standing Rock, there were many, many women in leadership positions, not so true for the American Indian movement at the second takeover of Wounded Knee, among other, protests. So I can't help but see sort of the Dakota Access Pipeline protest, for instance, being much healthier than the protests we saw in the 70s in terms of its overall politics, in terms of its gender politics. And another thing that those protests, these more modern protests, recognize is that it's important to build coalitions between tribes, between natives and non-natives. They rightly see that this question of energy dependence is an issue that affects all of us. And so they were more than willing to work with and empower non-native allies. And it was really comical to see like movie stars like Mark Ruffalo came to Standing Rock in support. And I couldn't help but notice that within an hour of landing, he was standing at a meeting telling people how it should be, which generated all sorts of jokes about, the prophecy of the sacred white Ruffalo as opposed to the sacred white buffalo. But the women at these meetings, the men at these meetings, they'd been around the block. They were patient with him. And within a couple weeks, Mark Ruffalo learned that he couldn't speak for Native people and that he couldn't just fly in and tell people how it was going to be. That if he was going to make any kind of difference, he had to work with Native people. He had to listen to Native people. And he learned that. And so now I see him still engaging in activism in ways that are, at least for him and for us, much healthier, much more respectful, a lot less sacred white Ruffalo, and much more of an ally. And maybe, 30, 40 years ago, we would have been overly impressed by his star power, for example. But he's dealing with savvy, smart, centered Native activists who could, help him see a better way, perhaps, of being. So I can't help but see the kinds of things that are happening at Standing Rock and subsequently at pipelines that are one across Minnesota now. They're protests ongoing now, or protests in Minneapolis regarding the treatment of homeless people, not just Native homeless people, and there are quite a few in Minneapolis, as being so much more productive, so much healthier, so much more effective than protests in the past, because we've learned from both the positive and negative example of the American Indian movement.
And in the Trump era, I mean, it really seemed that the Dakota Access Pipeline, I mean, had achieved tremendous victories. And then Trump comes in and he just, you know, uses his executive power to wipe out all progress. You know, certainly Native Americans have faced worse before. But what do you see going forward in terms of building on the strengths of the kind of lessons learned that you've just spoken about to not slide backwards, to make real gains?
Well, I mean, what would I say? I mean, you know, my father died before Trump took office and before that election. And I'm kind of glad he didn't live to see that and to have him sort of the last presidency that he was a part of in his own way to be this one. But I remember when Bush won back in the day against Gore and how frustrated I was. And he said, look, if I can live through FDR, who was amazing, and Truman, who was less so, and Eisenhower, who is sort of an empty suit, and if I can live through the assassination of Kennedy and then the assassination of Martin Luther King and the assassination of Robert Kennedy, if I can live through the disappointments of Chappaquiddick, and if I can live through the Nixon presidency and Reagan, he's like, look, you keep fighting, it'll be okay. You know, this is something we can manage. We will survive, and our ideals will survive, and the gains that we've made, so perhaps we experience setbacks, but we will gain again if we are patient and if we are balanced. And I remember that. I think about that when I think about Trump, but I also think about, you know, hey, you know, in the last 500 years, Native people, we survived slavery and smallpox and the measles. We've survived the Spanish, the English, the French. We've survived Custer. He didn't survive us, but nonetheless, we have survived every assault on our being for 500 years, not just survive. We found ways to thrive. We have found ways to sort of remind America of its better nature during the times of its worst behavior. And Trump is no exception. We will survive this and we won't start over. And for that matter, you know, that pipeline got pushed through. And even if Trump hadn't been elected and Hillary had won, the pipeline still might have been pushed through. Why? Because we've empowered a government that privileges private ownership and commercial enterprise over the common good. That's the kind of government we have, no matter whether we elect a Republican or a Democrat. We're empowering rapacious capitalism. Obama was no different, you know, just to be a spoil sport. I mean, Obama was great and much better than Trump. There's no doubt about it. But he too bent over backwards for corporations. He too was sort of a promoter of aggressive capitalism. That's the real culprit here. And so it may feel like we've been set back, but and we have in material ways, but in some ways we haven't. After the pipeline protests at Standing Rock, no tribal government, no state government, and the federal government can't just plan on pushing through a pipeline. Before Standing Rock, my tribe had greenlit various pipeline projects to cross my reservation. After Standing Rock, there is no way any of our tribal leaders could expect to be reelected if they promoted a pipeline. So it had profound and lasting effects, Standing Rock did. The end game for Standing Rock wasn't so good. The results weren't so good specifically in that particular instance, but that's not the only pipeline that's going through places. And tribes will no longer just take whatever leases are pushed in their faces by coal companies and oil companies and uranium mining companies, because our citizenry are empowered to resist that. It's become a new value of Native people, and not just Native people, but disenfranchised rural people, farmers, and other people who live in what we call flyover states, are not just going to roll over for these companies anymore. And Standing Rock is a big reason why. So it's not back to square one. It's, you know, keep on fighting.
Wow. Well, on that really hopeful note, and thank you so much for that. We want to thank you for this whole conversation here, David Troyer. This has been a really wonderful conversation, and your book also is just terrific. I just cannot recommend it more highly.
Thank you so much, and thanks for the conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
David Troyer. His book is The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. It will be published by Riverhead Books on January 22nd. David Troyer is the author of numerous books, including novels, essays, and memoir. He's a professor of literature and teaches in the University of Southern California's PhD program in creative writing and literature. The great poet Mary Oliver died on January 17th. Her work celebrated the natural world and our human place in it. I was first introduced to her work by my dear friend Meg Krugman, who writes pretty good poetry herself. The poem Meg shared with me that long ago day that opened me to Oliver's wonderful poetry has ever since been my favorite, Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. That was Wild Geese by Mary Oliver, who passed away this week at the age of 83. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at writersvoice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.